I want to try to think tonight about the meaning and the status of the land of Israel in religious Zionism. And in order to do that, I want to start by thinking about the meaning of the land in medieval Jewish thought. Because in many ways, the debate over the meaning of Eretz Yisrael in religious Zionism is really a reflection of, and maybe even a manifestation of, much older debates and disagreements. Only now, right, the difference between the Zionist conversation about the meaning of the land and the medieval philosophical conversation about the meaning of the land is that there is the possibility that these theological views translate into political programs, right? Whereas in the Middle Ages, they are more abstract philosophical questions. Like Maimonides and Yehuda Halevi can have some conversation about the meaning of the land, and it's an interesting question. Whereas some of the sort of reverberations of that conversation in the late 20th century, as we'll see, are both philosophical, theological, but also have very real implications for politics. So I should maybe say that in the ideal discussion of the land of Israel in Jewish thought, we would, of course, begin with Tanakh. But we have an extremely short time. And one of the interesting problems is it's not clear whether and how one could actually construct a unified picture of the conception of Eretz Yisrael in the range of biblical texts. In fact, it's sort of striking that such a central topic has received fairly little scholarly attention, precisely because people have a hard time methodologically figuring out, can I talk about the meaning of the land of Israel in the Bible, or can I only talk about the meaning of the land of Israel in Dvarim, or Yeshayahu, or Amos, etc.? And that raises all kinds of questions about how we think about what the Tanakh is in general, and especially around this question. Also, my real justification for beginning with the medievals is I think that they are much more directly the raw material out of which the religious Zionist world works. Okay. So now, a one-sentence framing comment about medieval Jewish experience and the land of Israel more broadly. Eliezer Schweid, one of the great scholars, Israeli scholars of philosophy and philosophers in his own right, says something that I think is very astute about the way Jews in the Middle Ages dealt with or experienced Eretz Yisrael. On the one hand, the realities of geography and accessibility were such that the land of Israel was very far away and essentially inaccessible. And in a certain way, as a result, it gets shrouded in myths and in legends. It's this very faraway place that is, you know, Eretz Avat Chalav Dvash, it is filled with honey and milk, and some people even imagine that to be some kind of literal description. On the other hand, the tenuousness of the Jewish people's status as a religious, cultural, and political minority means that the yearning for Eretz Yisrael never quite fades and doesn't allow it to become just a myth. Now, is that clear what I just said? In other words, on the one hand, the political reality makes Eretz Yisrael this sort of idealized construction. On the other hand, the sort of anxiety that I might need to go there keeps it from being just an idealized construction. It has a kind of hold on reality. And it's important to just sort of keep that in mind as we go. So, in the Middle Ages, it's fair to say that Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, on the one hand, and Rambam, on the other, disagreed about virtually everything. And as a way of getting into the question of what the land of Israel means in Jewish thought, I want to think a little bit about each of them and each of them together, and both of them together. So I'm going to start by saying a few words about Yehuda Halevi that when I first start saying them are going to seem wildly irrelevant to anything you came here to talk about. But just bear with me for a few sentences, we'll get somewhere, I hope, important. According to Aristotle, the only form of experience that can generate any knowledge is sense experience. And thus, the only thing we can know for sure is about the sensible, physical world. Yehuda HaLevi, at least at one point in his life, is very much in deep conversation with Aristotle, and yet he wants to move beyond Aristotle in this one basic, earth-shattering way. And that is, he insists that there is another type of experience beyond sense experience that is possible, and that is a direct experience of the metaphysical through a different kind of sense, what we might call the inner sense. What is unique about a prophet is that this inner sense does the work of accessing metaphysical truth. In other words, there is a level of experience and a level of reality that can only be accessed through this special sense that essentially is prophecy. So there's, on the one hand, the stuff that all of us, by dint of being human, can access, and then there are the levels of reality and experience that can be accessed only through prophecy. By the way, it should go without saying that one can't prove such a claim. Right? But it's crucial for everything Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi is going to develop is the sense that another kind of experience and therefore another kind of knowledge and therefore access to another kind of reality is in fact possible. That means that a prophet is a unique kind of being. In a certain way, you can say that for HaLevi, a prophet is an intermediate form of being between a human being on the one hand and the world of the angels and the divine glory on the other. A prophet is human but more than human, according to HaLevi. Let's put it one other way. The difference for Yehuda HaLevi between man and the animals is the capacity for thought. The difference, in turn, between man and, already for some people this will be a little bit striking, the difference between man and Jews is that the latter have the capacity for prophecy, that is, this extra inner sense. Okay? Now, all of this means, that some people are already squirming in their seats, but I think it's very important to try and understand what's going on here, right? All of this means that there is a hierarchy between Israel and the nations that is about a fundamental difference. It's, in some sense, you could say, it's not a quantitative difference, it's a qualitative difference. A Jew is a different kind of creature than anyone else. That is, Jewishness has an ontology to it. Right? It is built into the structure of being. Now, we could have a long discussion, were this a seminar on medieval Jewish thought, about whether and when it makes sense to describe a medieval philosophical theory as racist. Right? I think that's a very important and interesting discussion. It's not a discussion that I want to have now, but I want to make a couple of comments about this. Okay? First is, it's important to know, just to have a rounded out picture of Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, first of all, that he goes to great lengths to manifest that he does not hate non-Jews, and further, that this essential difference between Jews and Gentiles is not manifest in crude ways. So that, for example, he sort of explicitly does not argue that Jews necessarily have better human qualities than other people. And he argues for a kind of admittedly triumphalistic universalism that says Jews are the heart, the rest of the world are the limbs, and the heart is responsible for the well-being of the limbs. Now, corresponding to this, okay, so we now have this category of the Jews, of Am Yisrael, as this ontologically essential entity. That is to say, if they are a different form of being. By the way, If your response to this is profoundly troubling, don't worry, right? The Rambam read Halevi and felt more strongly than you do. Right? And we're going to get to this, because I think this is going to be a very, very interesting way of thinking about how Jews imagine the world and their place within it. Now, there is a kind of parallel, right? What's true about B'nai Israel, about the people of Israel, also is true, according to Halevi, about the land of Israel. Eretz Israel is, the meaning of Eretz Israel in some sense, is that it is the place where prophecy can take place. There are two kinds of prophecy, according to Halevi. There is the prophecy that takes place in Eretz Israel, and there are the rare occasions of prophecy that take place elsewhere, but they are always about or in service of Eretz Israel. Eliezer Shride has a wonderful term for this. Academics are amazing at this. He speaks for Halevi of the geotheological uniqueness of the land of Israel. The geotheological uniqueness, meaning it is a place, a piece of land that has an absolutely essential theological difference from any other place. This geography, this kind of construction of a sacred geography, is based on the prophets. Eretz Israel is the center of the world. Jerusalem is the center of Eretz Israel. And the temple, in turn, is the center of Jerusalem. And there is a whole, just as there is an ontology of Jewish peoplehood, there is an ontology of the Jewish land. So Eretz Israel is, according to Halevi, the portal that connects the heavenly sphere with the earthly sphere. It is the place of connection of God and earth, and therefore it alone is a place of prophecy. Every prayer uttered by a human being ascends to heaven through this location called Eretz Israel. Therefore, it is always better to pray in Eretz Israel, because as it were, you're praying next to the portal. And Halevi goes to lengths to argue that the people of Israel in the land of Israel uniquely manifests the best qualities of both. Right? The people of Israel can only achieve their true greatness, and the land of Israel can only manifest its true riches when the two of them are brought together. Now, we now know that Rambam, Maimonides, read the Kuzari, and I think we can safely say that he didn't like it. And it's maybe important conceptually to understand that, in a way, the Guide of the Perplexed has a diametrically opposed project to the Kuzari. The Kuzari, or Yehuda Halevi's central text, is in some fundamental sense all about Israel's uniqueness. If you've ever studied the Guide of the Perplexed, you realize it's about a lot of things. It is not about Israel's uniqueness. In fact, as some Zionist thinkers will later point out, isn't it interesting, they point this out with some anxiety, that Maimonides doesn't list the uniqueness of the land of Israel, I'm sorry, the election of Israel, or the uniqueness of the land of Israel, as one of his principles of faith. Something some of them find surprising. The truth is they could have gone much farther than this, because I think there is only one place in Maimonides' whole corpus where he explicitly talks about the chosenness, the election of Israel. This is a very minor theme in Maimonides' thought. You might even say, at the risk of digressing for a minute, you might even say that for Halevi, one begins with the particular, and then the question is, how do you make sense of the universal? And for Maimonides, at least philosophically, he begins with the universal, and then has to figure out what exactly is the meaning of the particular. That's why, for Halevi, the central core testimony in Judaism is the story of the Exodus and Sinai. Whereas for Maimonides, strikingly, the central story in Jewish theology is the creation of the world. A story about humanity, and not only or explicitly about Israel. So you can already imagine, just based on this sort of like 2-minute construction, right, how diametrically opposed these two worldviews really are. Rambam, in other words, reads the Khuzari's essentialism, that is, the notion that the Jewish people and the land of Israel are ontologically unique entities, that they have unique structure in being. And Rambam counters with a kind of systematic anti- or non-essentialism. The Jewish people and the land of Israel are not ontologically unique in any way. When it comes to the creation of the world, the Jews are like anybody else. And the land of Israel is a land like any other land, except that God has given certain mitzvot around it. Now, for those of you interested in medieval philosophy, we can say this in a slightly different way. Rambam was, here like the bells of college philosophy classes should start ringing, the Rambam was a nominalist, which means that universal or abstract categories don't exist. They're just that. They're convenient ways of categorizing things that are real, which are particular things. In other words, for the Rambam, there's no such entity as Israel, the Jewish people. The Jewish people is just a collection of a bunch of individuals. You can't talk the way Halevi does of some metaphysically unique substance called Israel, let alone the way Kabbalah will speak of Knesset Yisrael as this structure in the universe. Things like that don't exist. Prophecy. Now watch how this develops parallel and sort of antithetically to Halevi. Prophecy is a kind of human perfection. So the prophet is not more than a person, but rather a supremely excellent person. And I use excellent here not in the sort of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, but excellent in the sense of medieval philosophy, right? I just dated myself in a humiliating way. But, okay, so the fact that Israel has prophets doesn't mean at all, therefore, that Israel, the Jewish people, are somehow this ontologically distinct entity. Because after all, a prophet is just a person who has achieved a certain level of excellence. The uniqueness of Israel, the Rambam insists, is this. It receives Torah, and it retains its uniqueness only as long as it obeys the aspirations and commandments of Torah and Mitzvot. To quote something that, for those of you who are full-time in the yeshiva, I mentioned on Friday night, the wonderful image for this from the scholar of medieval philosophy, Daniel Lasker, is that Halevi insists that that the people of Israel are unique in terms of hardware. Whereas the Rambam comes along and says, wait a second, the uniqueness of Israel is always only software. Right? That is to say, it is what is put into the system, not the system itself. Is that image clear to people? Right? It's the program that I run, not the being. There's nothing ontologically distinct. There's nothing distinct about the being of a Jew. It's only the culture that a Jew is taught. What this means concretely is that for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, holiness is inherent in certain bodies and objects, whereas for Rambam, holiness as a purely spiritual thing means that things can't be holy in themselves. Put differently, and if we want, we can try to explain this more clearly later. Holiness, you can say for the Rambam, is institutional rather than ontological. There are structures that declare certain things holy in practical terms. But it doesn't mean that those things are metaphysically distinct. Now, one of the things I think is interesting when I talk about this is, I guess that a majority of people sitting in this room or watching this would think, well, of course I'm on Maimonides' side. And yet, it's interesting how pervasive Rabbi Yehuda Halevi's assumptions are in much of medieval Jewish culture. And Kabbalah, which I don't have time to get into now, is, you might say, Yehuda Halevi on steroids, right? In this question, meaning the absolute distinctiveness of Eretz Yisrael and Am Yisrael, of the land of Israel and the people of Israel. I'll try to say it one more way, which maybe is helpful. And here I'm borrowing from Menachem Kellner, another contemporary scholar of medieval philosophy, who says, for Rambam, holiness, claims about Israel's holiness are normative, but they're never descriptive. Is that clear what that means? Meaning, right, my holiness comes from my attempt to live up to a certain set of norms and aspirations. But it's not descriptive in the sense that I can't just say, oh, I'm Jewish, I'm holy. That, to go back to something I talked about on Friday night, the notion of I'm Jewish, I'm holy, is the theology of Korach. Kol ha'edah kulam kedoshim, right? We're holy. As opposed to kedoshim to you, you should strive to be holy. Now, there's a lot more to say here. And in the interest of time, I won't say all of it, but I want to point out a couple of very concrete consequences of this. That is, for Rambam, the mitzvah of Yishuv Haaretz, the mitzvah of settling the land, is not, I want to say it as forcefully and dramatically as I can, because this will have huge implications for the world of religious Zionism, it is not because the land is somehow intrinsically holy, but because of two interrelated realities. Number one, what has taken place there in the past, and number two, what can be fulfilled there in terms of the will of God. So, in other words, history and commandments. The land of Israel is holy because the Jewish people settled it and made it a place of their covenant with God, and because there are a variety of mitzvot that are given that can only be fully played out there. And the Rambam emphasizes, if you read him closely, that what the sages consider the permanent holiness of the land of Israel is a result of history, not ontology. It's a result of the fact that it was settled. Kedushah Sheniyah, right, the second settling of the land, affects the land of Israel historically, not metaphysically. I'll give you just one more almost random example just to understand how stark this divide is. Halevi makes the claim that the fact that the Jewish calendar centers around the land of Israel, and that we set days and times by the land of Israel, is because the land of Israel is the center of the universe, and it makes sense that we structure time around the metaphysical center. The Rambam essentially says, here I'm, the idiom is mine, but the thought is his, give me a break. Right? We center Jewish time around the land of Israel because that's a convention. That's how Jews mark time. Maybe you could say, perhaps only a little bit simplistically, right? The Rambam comes along and says, in this sense, we should be a lot more metaphysically modest than you, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, have allowed yourself to be. Okay, so we have here, really, the land of Israel as a central manifestation, together with the people of Israel, you could say, the two central manifestations of a more fundamental divide and orientation between these two schools of medieval Jewish thought. The Rambam, the refusal of any kind of essentialism, and Halevi, the absolute placement at the center of a consistent essentialism. Okay? That's kind of the medieval frame of how at least philosophers in the Middle Ages are struggling with what does it mean that culture and Torah are centered on a piece of land and property. Okay. So, religious Zionism. How does this debate, this disagreement, play itself out? So first, I'd like to just say a couple of sort of meta things about the religious Zionist debate, and then sort of play it out, where I will use very briefly Rabbi Isaac Jacob Reines, who we spoke about last week, and Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who we mentioned briefly last week, as, in a way, the continuation of the Maimonidean line of medieval Jewish thought, and then Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook and Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, as the continuation and intensification of the Yehuda Halevi line. So first, a couple of general observations. It's maybe helpful to think about the question of Eretz Yisrael in religious Zionist discourse as the question of, can I talk about the intrinsic holiness of the land, or is the land of Israel so valued because of instrumental reasons? That is, because it is the place where Torah and mitzvot and or Jewish national life can best be played out. Is there something about the land itself that is different? Is there something about the fabric of Jerusalem that's different from the fabric of Paris? If I were in a more obnoxious mood, I would ask, is there anything that's ontologically different between the fabric of Tel Aviv and the fabric of Paris? Right? Now, that was an attempt at a joke, but it failed miserably. Now, okay? Or does the land merely serve, and this merely shouldn't be seen as merely, it's a big deal, but it's very different, as a place where other ideals can play themselves out? Dov Schwartz, particularly astute scholar of the history of Jewish thought, uses, I think, the helpful image of that the view that the land of Israel is intrinsically holy can be categorized as the theology of Eretz Shmeimit, the heavenly earth. Whereas the theology according to which the land has merely instrumental value is Eretz Artzit, an earthly land. The earthly approach has a variety of variants, and I just want to mention briefly two in particular, right? And this is, you will recognize this most likely if you know anything about European nationalism, right? There is a kind of rational approach that says, oh, this land, or you might say a rationalist approach, this land is my land because it is where I can play out my culture, my religion, whatever. Versus a romantic approach, capital R, that says, or posits, that there's some kind of organic connection between the land and the nation. Now, I just want to underline for a second that an organic connection between the land and the nation does not yet mean that I have a metaphysics of this piece of earth. Right? Many people could argue that nation X has an organic connection to land Y without thereby claiming that land Y is an ontologically unique entity that is radically different from any other piece of earth. You might say that the organic approach is already taking a first step towards a metaphysics, but it's far from a metaphysics. Okay? Now, the heavenly approach, and here you should hear the loud echo of Yehuda Halevi, is that Eretz Yisrael is a metaphysical entity. The land of Israel and the people of Israel are both metaphysically unique entities, and something powerful, even messianic, happens when these ontologically distinct, unique entities are brought together. Right? The uniting of the ontologically unique people with the ontologically unique land yields cosmic transformation. This is what we might call, I'm making this up as I go, but this is what we might call a kind of theological maximalism, right? About the meaning of nation and place. Right? Lots is at stake. It has cosmic repercussions. And as we'll see this evening, and even more dramatically next week, the Cookean school of religious Zionism is uninhibited about going precisely to those places, right? These very maximalist places where seemingly earthly things about a people entering a land become cosmically reverberative acts, right? The cosmos shakes with this development. I'll just say as a footnote, which again we can't go into at length, is that Kabbalah becomes extremely important here, where the land of Israel is understood to manifest or reveal aspects of the divine that would otherwise remain covered. Now, a little bit at the end of tonight, and at some length during the sixth and final lecture, I will lament the fact that the heavenly approach, the notion of Eretz Shmeimit, is far and away the dominant one in religious Zionist circles, so much so that after a time, the other one is largely drowned out and forgotten. The colossal figure of Rav Kook induces a kind of forgetting or erasure of the much more rationalist approach to the meaning of the land of Israel. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, theological ideas have, or at least we should say, can have, real political implications. And it's important to stop and think about, I'm encouraging you to do this, I'm not going to do this yet, right? The potential political implications of having a robustly metaphysical view of what the land of Israel is. What political consequences might that generate, or might it even necessarily generate? Okay, we're not going to answer that question fully, but we'll certainly come back to it in a little while. Okay. So now, what I'm going to call, not unproblematically, the Maimonidean strand, the instrumentalist strand. And I'll cover this strand as clearly as I can. And one of the things I hope that you'll notice, and this will come up again very dramatically next week when we talk about messianism and non-messianism, is that even if there's something disturbing to many about this metaphysicalization of the land and the people, there's also something enormously alluring about it if you're basically risking life and limb to settle a place. Right? Am I going to Israel to risk getting malaria because, instrumentally, this place is a place where I can play out Torah, or because I am entering a zone of the cosmos that is utterly unique and my going there reverberates throughout the whole universe? You may find the latter unconvincing, but you also might understand its allure. And I think that that's actually quite important in thinking sympathetically about views that we might find not fully convincing. I hope I'll talk more about that, and if not, during the question and answers, I can say more about that. As we saw last week, for Rabbi Isaac Jacob Reines, Zionism was, first and foremost, a response to anti-Semitism, right? The land is fundamentally a safe haven. That's the fundamental first meaning of the land of Israel. That is, it is the only answer to anti-Semitism. Or in Rav Reines' language, Mekom Miklat Batuach Be'eretz Avoteinu. A place that constitutes a safe haven in the land of our forefathers. Interestingly, this is a footnote, very central to Reines' view is the importance of restoring Jewish honor. What he calls, he has various terms for this, let's call it Kavod L'Umi, national honor. Others in Reines' generation will speak of returning national health, Briut L'Umit, that in the land, and in the land alone, we can achieve our fullest moral well-being, our most authentic freedom, and our fullest strength. Now, footnote to this, okay? There is, in such a claim, an acceptance and an internalization of a profound critique of diaspora Jewish culture. Right? When someone comes along and says, we can be uniquely moral, uniquely strong, and uniquely free in the land of Israel, they are implicitly making a claim about what we cannot be in Galut. Footnote to the footnote, right? In a seminar on Zionism more broadly, we would have to think about the importance of gender imagery in a lot of this kind of language that Zionists use. Zionism as a recovery of Jewish masculinity. There is a lot to say about that. Zionist thinkers as preoccupied with their internalized sense that a yeshiva bachur is nothing if not emasculated. I'm not asking you to endorse this view. I'm asking you to understand it, right? Yeshiva Bachar is nothing. Everything's failed, slumped over, right? Right? And Zionism is about, right, the possibility of the Jewish man becoming a man again. Now that, of course, raises really interesting and important questions about the role of women in the history of Zionism. By the way, there's a lot of scholarship, this is my footnote to my footnote to my footnote, there's a lot of scholarship in general about gender and nationalism, and the maleness of all kinds of nationalist movements, or the use of the recovering of masculinity as a central motif. Reines is very concerned with the recovery of Jewish honor, which I think can't be fully disentangled with the recovery of becoming a man. And again, what that means for gender is very interesting. Now, Reines says something that I want to sort of emphasize and underline here, precisely because by the time we start talking about the rabbi's cook, this kind of sentence will be unimaginable. Reines says, ethnicity, language, and religion are an integral, intrinsic part of the nation. Land, in contrast, is an external aspect of the nation. That is to say, it is the aspect of the nation that makes the other intrinsic qualities possible. Right? Language, religion, and ethnicity are intrinsic. The land enables the playing out of those aspects. It is, in an image Reines uses, the land is the body that makes the life of the soul possible. The life of the soul, presumably, is ethnicity, language, and especially religion. Right? So, Eretz Yisrael is a place and a context to play out Torah. Note here, right? Okay? The importance of the land is halachic and nationalistic. It is a place to live out the Torah, and it is a place to reach maturation as a people. There is nothing about metaphysics at all. The land happens to be the place that God and our ancestors chose. Now, of course, when I say the land that God happened to choose, that's a bizarre sentence. But I say it that way in order to make clear the contrast between a land that God chose and the land that is its own metaphysically unique substance. Now, Reines is extremely strong about Zionism requiring Yishuv Haaretz, the mitzvah of settling the land. In lecture 4 about violence, I will go to great lengths to show you that for Reines, Yishuv Haaretz means buying the land and does not in any context mean conquering it. This is very, very important to him. He goes so far as to say that the aspiration to Yishuv Haaretz is an ikar emunah. It is a foundation of Jewish faith, and he contends that one who isn't engaged in the project of Yishuv Haaretz demonstrates thereby that he or she does not believe in God. If you don't think that the land and the people need to be reunited, you obviously don't believe anything that you read in the prophets. That's the structure of the argument. That is to say, a rejection of the land is kfira be'elohim, is a rejection of God. Now, a motif appears in Reines that will appear over and over and over again in Zionist thought, not just religious Zionist thought, and that is that the people can't function anywhere else as well as they can in Israel, and that the land cannot be fully settled by any other nation. In Reines' case, this is because divine providence has so decreed. And if you spend any time in non-Haredi day schools or in Jewish youth movements, you may be familiar with the rhetoric of the Jews draining the swamps, right? The land of Israel gave itself only to us, right? So Reines here has some sense here that the land cannot be fully settled by any other people. Now, Reines' line on this and on many other issues is continued by Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, who gives a kind of existentialist spin, not surprisingly, to Reines' ideas. And I want to try to explain them very kind of in a truncated way, and then if there's time later and people want to pursue this, we can talk about it. Acquisition of the land, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, Kinyan Haaretz, requires two things. One, active settlement That is the halakha, after all. And two, here this really interesting existentialization of a motif in rabbinic literature, sacrifice and suffering on its behalf. The way that you acquire the land, according to Rabbi Soloveitchik, is A, by settling it, and B, by suffering because of your connection to it. Now, both of those ideas actually point to a real earthly place rather than some abstract metaphysical entity. It is a concrete place in which and to which the halakha can be applied. It is a place where I can fulfill all kinds of mitzvot that are distinctively there. Distinctively applicable there. But there's nothing at all in Soloveitchik about the metaphysics of this place. Interestingly, and this will recall for those who were here, something I said at the very introduction of last week about how religious Zionism is a minority within a minority. It's a double minority culture. Soloveitchik says that the religious Zionist community makes the greatest sacrifice among all Zionists on behalf of the land and suffers most deeply. Why? Because it is lonely and alienated by the fact that a majority of the Torah world thinks it has abdicated the Torah by being Zionist, and a majority of the Zionist world thinks that it has abdicated on Zionism by being committed to Torah. And so the existential loneliness that the religious Zionist, Soloveitchik contends, exhibits is the suffering whereby he or she enacts Kinyan Eretz Yisrael, the acquisition of the land of Israel. Now, there are occasions when Soloveitchik does seem to talk about the land in metaphysical terms, but one particularly, I think, good reader of Soloveitchik points out something very interesting. If you've ever studied Soloveitchik, let alone if you're studying Soloveitchik with me, this will not be totally surprising to you. He says that when Soloveitchik talks about the metaphysical qualities of the land of Israel, he is describing a subjective consciousness, but he never presumes to be describing a metaphysical reality. That is to say, I can experience the land as metaphysically unique. I can, you know, okay, this is now 1974. I get off the El Al plane. I've just finished clapping for the pilots, right? Some of you are looking like I'm crazy, right? But I've just finished clapping for the pilots. I get off and I feel, oh my God, I have never been anywhere in which the air is anything like this, right? Soloveitchik says, let's be clear, right? That's a description of my consciousness. Now, if you want to be philosophical about this, Soloveitchik has read his Kant very well. This means what I can describe is how my mind and myself experience the land. But I make no claim at all about the nature of the land itself. If I wanted to be just gratuitously pretentious, I would say Soloveitchik describes the phenomenon of the land, but nothing at all about the noumenon of the land. Nothing about the land itself, only my experience thereof. He makes no claim about the latter. Now, we'll see, maybe next week, maybe in the last week, that this notion, and Soloveitchik gets played out more forcefully in later thinkers, perhaps most importantly in David Hartman, for whom the land's meaning is simply that it is the place where Torah and mitzvot can be played out. Sof pasuk. Right? End of story. And according to Hartman, right, in some ways, Zionism, this would surprise the people we're about to talk about, is a rejection of the Halevian school. Right? It's about Eretz Yisrael being a real place. Okay. Now, that's the instrumentalist strand. The land of Israel has a purpose. For the metaphysical strand, think back for a minute to the Kuzari. Right? The land of Israel and the people of Israel are both metaphysically unique entities that need to be brought together. And doing so is participating in a cosmically significant process. We'll talk about this, as I mentioned, at length next week. Return to Zion, in other words, is a manifestation of a much more fundamental yearning to use the language of Rav Kook, tikkun ha-havaya kula, right? The repair of all of existence. The yearning of the Jewish people for this place is actually a tapping into, an essential manifestation of, a much more fundamental yearning for the whole cosmos to be redeemed. So Zionism is, in the thought of Rabbi Abraham Isaac Kook, at one level, a people returning to its homeland, and at another, a people returning to the source and center of all holiness. Those are not the same thing, right? And according to Rav Kook, it's both. And I would go so far as to say that as Rav Kook gets older, it becomes more the second and less the first. Like Eretz Yisrael becomes more and more of a cosmic entity. There's a process whereby the land first takes on personal attributes, and it seems like, in his case, that's not just metaphorical, and it finally ends up as a metaphysical substance, what he calls chativa atzmutit, and yesod tikkun ha'olam kulo. It is its own unique structure, and it is the foundation of the redemption of the entire cosmos. It's perhaps not surprising that Rav Kook, and especially the older he gets, emphasizes how important it is for this generation to be taught Kabbalah, because he thinks only Kabbalah can explain the mystery of the meaning of the land of Israel, which is, after all, Eretz HaRazim, the land of secrets. And in order to understand Eretz HaRazim, you have to teach Torah HaRazim, right? That is Kabbalah. Now, just to gratuitously confuse us for a minute, right? Rav Kook goes so far as to assign certain sefirot. The land of Israel is a reflection of Sirat Yesod. Yerushalayim is a manifestation of Sirat Malchut. I'm not sure what this means. I think what it at least means is that Eretz Yisrael manifests the divine in a way that other parts of the world don't, and that the divine presence on earth flows distinctly through this place. Jerusalem being higher up than the land of Israel suggests that it is in some way a less material place. It is a more ethereal, purely spiritual place. Now, Rav Kook, like many Kabbalists, is kind of obsessed with the notion of unity. Right? You can say that much of Kabbalistic piety is about seeing unity where other people only see fracturedness. Alma de Peruda, the world of fracturedness. And he makes the claim that the land of Israel is the place where things that seem separate can be united. In the land of Israel, Gashmiut and Ruchaniut, materiality and spirituality, can be wholly made one. What appears separate can be discerned in its wholeness. And this gets played out in all kinds of very dramatic ways, so that Rav Kook seems to believe that my mere physical presence in the land of Israel has an immediate spiritual impact on me. So that the rabbinic idiom, Avira de Eretz Yisrael Machkima, the land, the air of the land of Israel makes one wise, is not some kind of hyperbolic statement, but is true in some built into the universe kind of way. In contrast, by the way, and we should not negate this or miss this, in arguing that the land of Israel has a uniquely positive impact, implicit for Rav Kook is that Chutz La'aretz, outside of the land, has negative spiritual consequences. I would only point out that this means that for Rav Kook, Shlilat HaGolah, the negation of the diaspora, a central motif in Zionist thought, is not merely political or cultural, it's actually metaphysical. Right? It is a negation of the damage done by the less pure lands. Now, just to clarify a couple of things here, and then I'll talk about Tzvi Yehuda quickly, and then I'll panic about what time it is. Okay? Land for Rav Kook obviously does have some instrumental value. That is, it helps Jewish nationalism reach its full maturity, as we saw. It helps along the cosmic process of redemption, which is in some kind of instrumental value. But it is also much more, right? It is, again, to use that image, chativa atzmutit. It is a metaphysically unique entity. Other Zionist thinkers, religious and non-religious, spoke poetically, often very movingly, about the project of reuniting a people and its land after centuries, millennia of separation. But again, for Rav Kook, what's so important is that that process is cosmic and metaphysical, not merely historical or even romantic with a capital R. All of this means, right, that the land of Israel simply cannot be understood in purely rational terms. Okay, now, Tzvi Yehuda Kook, Rav Kook's son, Tzvi Yehuda Kook was not really an original philosopher. He's not really a philosopher in some ways at all. And his project, and for many people in this room, you can begin to hear a certain alarm bell, right? His project is, keeping in mind that Rav Kook, the father, I talk about Rav Kook, I mean the father, I talk about Tzvi Yehuda, I mean the son. Rav Kook dies in 1935, before a whole lot of things happen, like the Holocaust and the birth of the State of Israel, right? Tzvi Yehuda sets out to apply the fairly abstract theology of his father to concrete aspects of contemporary reality. And he seeks to popularize and make these ideas accessible. And as I'll talk about next week, the universalism, the universalist side of Rav Kook begins to be sort of drowned out in Tzvi Yehuda, so that the consequence of saying that Jewish land is unique and that Jewish culture is unique is that other lands and other cultures are impure and that Jewish culture can close off to them completely. And we're going to talk about this, I think, at length in the final week. Because the irony is, you can say the sentence, Torah contains everything in it, and conclude from that, that therefore I should learn from everyone and everything. Or, you can conclude from that, Torah contains everything, therefore I can completely shut myself in, because everything that's worth knowing or having or being is already here. Tzvi Yehuda is a very dramatic manifestation of the latter. In a certain way, you can call him the dramatic charedization of potentially Haredi ideas in his father. Right? There's a kind of cultural enclosure. Now, he has some very dramatic formulations about the unity of the land and the nation. About what he calls ha-hadadiyut ha-elohit shel chilek enoshut zeh v'chilek geografi zeh. The divine mutuality of this people and this geographical place, or invoking Kabbalistic imagery, although I don't think he was all that interested in the Kabbalistic meaning of this, the bringing together of the land of Israel and the people of Israel is Zivug Elohi. It is a cosmic, it is a divine reuniting, and Zivug has sexual connotations. Footnote, as does calling Jerusalem and Israel Yesod and Malchut. But I leave that for those of you who, yeah, want to go there. Now, it's very clear, I'll explain later if it's relevant, okay? It's very clear, Tzvi Yehuda emphasizes at great length, please don't belittle the land of Israel by calling its significance instrumental. Eretz Yisrael eina emtza'i, lo legashmiut v'lo leruchaniyut. It is not a means to anything else. It is itself. Think about how far we've come now from the Rinus Soloveitchik line of understanding the land of Israel. Think about Maimonides doing somersaults in his grave, and think about Halevi being intensified. Right? The notion of Eretz Yisrael as a miklat batuach, as a safe haven, slowly fades away completely from the discourse of Tzvi Yehuda Cook and his circle, what we might refer to, at least in its early period, as the movement of Gush Emunim. Despite the fact that a kind of valiant minority tries to argue for the centrality of thinking of the land as Miklat Batuach, that is largely drowned out. And again, I really want to urge you to kind of go back to this point. Think about, if you had a choice between thinking about this place as a safe haven. By the way, let me make it even more intense for a second, okay? Coffee shops are blowing up left and right. You have the profound Zionist paradox that you're contemplating sending your kid to New York to be safe, right? Herzl has now done a somersault in his grave, right? What would make you stay? The notion of a safe haven, or the notion that this is the very center of the cosmos and it's a metaphysically distinct entity that holds the key to the redemption of the world? The scales are hard to balance in that instance. Now, that's not the only cheshbon, that's not the only calculation you would want to make. But again, the understanding the appeal is important. Now, Yaakov Filber, one of Tzvi Yehuda's students, says something I think is actually very helpful here. He says, let us not be confused. The land is not holy because it was given to Israel. The land was given to Israel because it is holy. Right? That is to say, holiness is intrinsic, deeply anti-Maimonidean. Now, this is where it becomes political. All of this generates an application of these ideas about the metaphysical entity that is Eretz Yisrael after the Six-Day War into the doctrine and the political program, more importantly, of Shlemut Haaretz, the wholeness of the land of Israel. Right? If the land of Israel is not merely an instrumental thing, but is actually some metaphysical reality, you can't carve it up. And the argument becomes essentially as follows, and here I'm essentially citing Dov Schwartz's analysis. If the people and the land represent an existential and ontological unity, if they really are in some sense in the fabric of the world united, then I'm going to use this image violently because I think it's actually helpful. To cut into the land is to cut into the people. An act of violence to the land is an act of violence to the people. By the way, I don't think it's hyperbole when people, during the Hitnat coup, during the disengagement, which we'll talk about, I hope, in the last lecture, said things like, Yehuda v'Shomron ze anachnu. Judah and Samaria is us. That's not rhetoric. It's not only rhetoric. It's also a theology that says, right, if you actually cut into one metaphysical entity, you also cut into the other metaphysical entity. No human being, this is sort of part two of this analysis, has the right to make decisions about an autonomous metaphysical entity. And thirdly, working on behalf of the wholeness of the land, Shlemut Haaretz, is a way of tapping into and participating in its unique holiness. It's a kind of spiritual catharsis. To fight for the land is to step into its holiness. Now, all of this leads, I would say, ineluctably, right, unavoidably, to what comes to be called very soon the practical political ideology of Afshal, or as we learn in America, not one inch. Right? Afshal. Because you can't carve up a metaphysical entity. It's a form of carving up yourself. Now, I want to explain a few things that Tzvi Yehuda Cook says that will render him deeply unpopular in this room, if he's not deeply unpopular already. But I think it's very important to understand how this sort of rhetorical escalation takes place. And also to understand that some of the politically fraught statements that some contemporary religious Zionist rabbis make are actually not their own innovation, but are at least in their origin, at least 35 years old. Right? So Tzvi Yehuda Cook says, as part of the theology of Afshal, of not one inch, that to surrender 1 millimeter of the land of Israel, actually his image is much more Jewish, Sroch Na'al, literally a shoelace of the land of Israel, falls under the category of Yehareg Ve'al Yavor. You should sooner be killed than allow 1 millimeter of the land to be surrendered. Sure enough, Tzvi Yehuda then says that any human decision that undermines Shlemut Haaretz, think about this already. You thought this was introduced in the 90s after Oslo. You thought this was introduced in 2004. Tzvi Yehuda says any human decision that undermines Shlemut Haaretz is in and of itself null and void and has no standing at all. And a government that acts in a way that undermines Shlemut Haaretz is guilty of, now listen for the residences, this is Tzvi Yehuda Cook talking in the 70s, is guilty of Begida. Any Jewish leader who surrenders an inch of the land of Israel is a bogey, is a traitor. Eventually, right, as I don't need to point out, that becomes the central demonization slogan around Rabin. Rabin Bogade is rooted in the theology of Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Tzvi Yehuda Cook went so far as to refuse to rule out the possibility of a civil war over returning territories. This is not the invention of his students, but actually of him himself. Right after the Yom Kippur War, when discussions in the culture emerge about land for peace, he says the following on Yom HaAtzmaut, right after the Yom Kippur War, Zelo yelech, zelo yavor b'li milchama, al gufotenu v'al evarenu, kulanu. I want to translate this. This will never happen over our dead body, every last one of us. Now, what the metaphysicalization, to make up a word, of the land means, among other things, is that no real dialogue is actually possible with anyone who doesn't share that view. Because when you argue, right, you can argue this is already true about Halevi, as I pointed out, right? You can't. If I tell you that through prophecy I have learned about a metaphysically distinct entity, and you say, but I don't share your premises, the conversation has officially broken down. Forget about the conversation between Israel and its enemies. It means the conversation between Tzvi Yehuda Circle and everybody else, including secular people who are sympathetic to the politics. Right? I think that's actually very important to understand. When you talk about the land as a metaphysical entity, you are inherently creating a closed circle of discourse. Now, no. Okay? Go back to this for a second. For Reines and Soloveitchik and people like them, Eretz Yisrael is a value. It's even a very important value. But it is not the essence of Judaism. For Tzvi Yehuda and his circle, it is the very foundation of Judaism in many ways. It is not a foundation. It is arguably the foundation. It and God are the foundations of what it means to be a Jew. Now, I want to just for a minute, at the risk of going longer than I would like to, I want to just mention someone that I'm guessing no one in this room has heard of, because I find him to be a particularly interesting character, and knowing something about him makes you realize the dramatic change that overtook religious Zionism post-1967. Moshe Una was one of the founders of the religious kibbutz movement, and he was, for a long time, a member of Knesset from the National Religious Party, that is, the Maftal. He leaves it after 2 decades to help form Meimad, right, the religious Zionist left. And we'll talk about him at some length, I hope, the last week, but I want to just mention something that he says as he sees all this unfolding. First, he says, the most important thing we can do right now is reassert the instrumentality of the land. That is, the land is the place that makes possible the redemption of the individual and the society. Obsession with the metaphysicalization and the metaphysical status of the land can only lead to le'umanut, that is, chauvinism, nationalist chauvinism, and potentially much worse. Ethics, he says, must always remain at the center of the Torah. What about, Tzvi Yehuda, the well-being of others? What it means to grow in ethics is that you understand that you always get less than the maximum you desire. By the way, I want to emphasize, this is a Knesset member from the Maftal, right? Today, he would not be allowed into a party meeting. Again, you must, he says, be able, if you want to be alive in this world, to distinguish between the ideal and the real. Between what you dream about, on the one hand, and what is possible. Between the matsui and the ratsui. Otherwise, we, he says, are headed into an abyss. And he asks, with some rhetorical force, isn't it possible, isn't it just maybe possible, that from a theological perspective, the Arabs here have a place in God's plans for us? Couldn't you, Tzvi Yehuda, be totally wrong? Now, I want to conclude by returning to a question I mentioned last time. I asked the question last time, what explains the obsession? Its critics say the monomania with the land that emerges post-1967. And if you recall, I suggested that if you're bought into a messianic narrative, the fact that there is no peace and no collective repentance means that the one thing you have to hold on to is, oh, but there is one piece of the messianic promise that's unfolding, that is Eretz Yisrael. So 1967 makes possible kind of seizing on to the one piece of the messianic drama that seems to be plausible. That is, and remember the euphoria. God just helped us win a war where we actually won back. Real Israel. Here, I just want to sort of add a footnote. One of the problems that religious people in Israel often, I would say legitimately, have with a lot of their secular critics is, don't talk like Hebron and Shechem are totally insignificant. We actually spend 2,000 years dreaming about those places, not Dizengoff. Right? So don't call me a Neanderthal for actually valuing the places that are actually our biblical heritage. So, the fact that the 67 war, right, Rabin, in one particular inopportune moment, refers to the entire Yehuda v'Shomron as Nichse Delo Naide, right? It's merely stuff you can't take with you, right? With utter derision. Now, for the religious Zionist, messianic, Kochian camp, in contrast, right? The conquest of those territories suggests this is the one thread of messianism I can hold on to. Now, I want to just share with you, and I'm gonna end with this, really and truly. What time is it actually? 8:40, right? Okay. Another interpretation of what this sort of obsession with the land is about, and here I'm quoting one of the most astute interpreters of Zionism, Avi Sagi. Avi Sagi says that something very interesting happened, and in a way it would be interesting to think about whether you could map his interpretation onto mine, and how. Avi Sagi says, look, what was the original fantasy of many religious Zionists when the state was being fought for? Medinat HaTorah. A state that will live according to the Torah. Now, there is a tremendous amount of diversity about what that means. Is that a full-blown theocracy? Is that a state that plays itself out in other applications of Jewish values that are more democratically applied? We'll talk about this in the fifth lecture, okay? But the fantasy of Medinat HaTorah is very important to many religious Zionist thinkers. And what happens over time is a belief that was always somewhat tenuous becomes all the more so. Because as religious Zionists ask themselves, sometimes explicitly and sometimes really implicitly, can it really be that this state and this society that are so stubbornly secular could really be on the path towards a Torah state and a Torah society? Or maybe let's put it in a more crude way, can the state of Israel really bear all the metaphysical luggage that we've placed on it? So in 1967, Sagi suggests something very interesting and fateful happens. Those thinkers turn their attention away from state and society, which to some extent they give up on, and replace it with land. Eretz Yisrael replaces Medinat Yisrael. And there's an interesting, I want to give you an interesting example of this. Rav Kook, the father, speaks about this Jewish state that is to come. Medinat Yisrael will be Kisei Hashem Ba'olam, God's chair, God's throne in the world. Rav Yehuda Amital, who later will do dramatic tshuva for this phase of his career, but at one point is the most theologically articulate of Tzvi Yehuda's students, writes in 1974 that settling the land is Binyan Malchut Hashem, is building the kingdom of God. So what Rav Kook, the father, talks about the state, Rav Amital transfers to the settling of the land. And in the interest of speaking well of great people, I want to emphasize this is stuff that I think Rav Amital spent much of the later part of his life wishing he had never written this very important book, Hama'alot Mimamakim, about a kind of Tzvi Yehuda inflected vision of redemption. In other words, right, the religious Zionist camp, or large parts of it, come to this view. Don't obsess with changing the face of secular society. That isn't the essence of our Zionism. Rather, the essence of our Zionism is Yishuv Haaretz, settling the land. The state's importance, after all, right, is not political, but metaphysical. And that means that the legitimacy of the state depends on its fulfilling its metaphysical duties. Otherwise, it has no legitimacy. In other words, Medinat Yisrael only has legitimacy as long as it serves the project of Shlemut Haaretz, Eretz Yisrael. The state of Israel only has legitimacy as long as it plays out the aspiration to the land of Israel. And I would like to say one last sentence, which in certain contexts would get me into big trouble, and I actually want to say this as a historian of religious Zionism, not at this moment as a partisan in its debates, although I also feel quite strongly about being that. That is, that it is increasingly unclear to me whether it makes sense to think of the far right of Tzvi Yehuda students as any longer Zionists at all. I want to sort of make sure this is, make this clear. Meaning, if Zionism traditionally means, if Zionism means the aspiration for Jewish sovereignty and a Jewish state in the land of Israel, increasingly a segment of the religious Zionist world has actively declared war on that. Oh, by the way, this is not even me talking, this is them talking, right? Because the state has no legitimacy if it doesn't serve its real purpose, which is the land. So I want to suggest, by the way, those of you who know me know, I'm not a fan of post-Zionism in any of its forms. But I do want to point out something very interesting, right? Which is, there is a post-Zionism on the right, just as there is a post-Zionism on the left. So that when rabbis that, some of whom I actually respect, right, say things like, okay, fine. I'm going to stay in this community and I'll live under a Hamas government. I'm willing to do that. They're not Zionists. They're something else. They might be Jewish nationalists of a certain kind. I actually, in some ways, don't think they are. Right? They are prioritizing something else rather than the notion of a Jewish state, assuming we define statehood that way. Maybe we could say it in a different way. If you want to say this in a more modest way, they are surely not political Zionists anymore. Right? Is that clear? They're not political Zionists. I say this, by the way, really, I want to emphasize this. I mean this as an analytical claim. I think it's like very important to grapple with this. Many people who did not share Tzvi Yehuda and his students' ideology, but felt it was important to protect and defend them, had no idea of the theology and the political program they were protecting and defending. And their project was, the supporters' project, was about what they understood to be the defense of the Jewish state. Little did they know that the Jewish state was a relative value to Tzvi Yehuda and his circle. And in that sense, I think it requires really kind of opening up the conversation about what does it mean to be a Zionist now? And those who want to write out parts of the Jewish world, for better or for worse, right or wrong, for being post-Zionists, I wonder whether one requires greater intellectual honesty about all the places where post-Zionism manifests itself. Okay, thank you very much.
I've been saving
up. Microphone. Speaking to the microphone because it's for the people on the computer. As it were.
I've been saving up, so I have actually five different questions.
Ask
one. The good news is that I've forgotten at least one of them.
Let's do one at a time.
You started out by saying that you don't want to get into Tanakh, A, because there's time, and B, because it's so diverse and multidimensional. One would have thought, or I would have thought, that it certainly in the view of the settler movement is very one-dimensional, namely, all the statements in the Tanakh that I give you this land forever and ever, it's yours, stay here and settle it. So I'm wondering if you could at least shed a little bit of light on what the nuances are that are otherwise. Before I forget, let me just run through the others. When Reines talks about the land...
Do one more, and then I want to...
Okay. When he talks about the land of Israel as a safe haven, was he either ignorant of or totally not caring about the fact that at the very moment he was saying that, there were fierce inhabitants of this land who were, by definition, going to be hostile to colonialists from Europe, and therefore the safety and the heaviness of it are, at best, subject to question.
Okay, thank you for asking me very brief, easy questions. First, you know, one of the things that one tries to do, I think, in a kind of scholarly way, is complicate or create a distinction between what a text says and the ways that a particular text has been received. Right? So all the time, I mean, the whole world of Maimonides scholarship, in a certain way, is about pointing out the difference between the Rambam and the Rambam as he's been imagined by various aspects of Jewish culture. So the fact that certain biblical texts are invoked in one political movement or another really, in certain ways, is immaterial, right? Because everyone cites biblical texts. I'll give you an example, right? There's an essay, I talked about this in my Akedah lectures last year, right? Uriel Simon, Israeli Bible scholar and one of the founders of Oz V'Shalom, the sort of predecessor to Meimad, has this wonderful essay which is explosively kind of controversial when he writes it. He basically says, he doesn't say these words, he says, you know, I'm sick and tired of people citing purportedly definitive biblical proof for a particular political project. So watch this. He says, what is Avram Avinu's greatness? Lo comes to Avram and says, Avram, my shepherds and your shepherds don't like each other. And Avram says, okay, you take half, I'll take half. Israel Simon says, that's it. I win. Right? You want to play this game? You want to play this game? Right? Is that what you want to do? And actually, Moshe Una, when we talked about in the last lecture, Moshe Una basically says, look, and here, by the way, he's incredibly courageous for a self-identified Orthodox thinker, capital O, to say such a thing. He says, look, right? There are texts Lechan, and there are texts Lechan, right? There are texts that go in all kinds of different directions, and the responsibility of being a receiver of the tradition is you pick which ones to prioritize based on theological and moral considerations. So yeah, right? You can decide, I'm going to read Sefer Dvarim, and I'm going to interpret it to mean that I should kill everyone I see. If you really want to do that, you can do that, right? But I could also quote Sefer Bereshit. Or I could talk about how the Bible is very clear that if you corrupt the land by immoral behavior, you will be kicked out of it. Be careful, lest like the Amori, the land vomit you out. So, we should always complicate the assumptions about a received text saying only the things one particular group of people thinks it says. By the same is true for whatever political group you would be sympathetic to, right? The Bible doesn't only say the things that Uri Simon wants it to say. It also says the things that Tzvi Yehuda Cook says it says. The Bible is a complicated book with lots in it. Hafochba vafochba de kulaba, right? There's a lot of stuff in it. Now, what does Rhinus think about the Arabs? I would say the following thing. Like almost everyone in 1902, he thinks almost not at all about the Arabs. And part of that is a kind of delusion. Part of that is actually, and here, I always get nervous about saying this because, you know, you get sort of hammered from every direction by trying to say something like this. It is not clear to anyone at all in 1902, including to most Arabs living in Palestine, that the Jewish national movement will unavoidably elicit a Palestinian national movement. Right? In fact, in 1902, there's nobody who calls himself a Palestinian. That's very important to understand. Now, the one person, by the way, famously, who sort of anticipates this is Ahad Ha'am, who in 1894, I believe it is, I'm not exactly sure, he pays a visit to Eretz Yisrael, and he writes a little essay called Emet Mi Eretz Yisrael, and Truth from the Land of Israel, and he basically says, oh boy, you really don't get it, do you? You think that you're going to come here as a nationalist movement and condescendingly tell them that you're going to improve their sewage and all their economic situation, and they're going to say thank you? Actually, what one national movement begets is another nationalist movement. So, be careful. But I want to emphasize, Haram writes that sentence, and never again for the rest of his career does he say anything about the Arab problem. The Arab problem is in quotation marks. That's how it was referred to politically. Meaning even he, who had this moment of prescience, right, of seeing, oh my God, one national movement, another national movement, all hell's going to break loose, even he doesn't fully see it. So I think it's a very complicated question, right? Trying to decide if I should say it in a more dramatic way, right? I think that Zionists, as a rule, did not imagine that one of the things that Zionism would invent is Palestinian nationalism. And I would be cautious about now blasting someone in 1902 for not seeing that. I would be cautious about that. Okay? So And that way, that's not intended as an apology. It's intended as just kind of thinking historically. Yeah, Nachman, please. Take Nachman one more, and then I guess we should. Well, go ahead. We'll decide.
Would you consider in your spectrum of thinkers, since you related to Rabin earlier, any statement about Nachman Begin, whether he was perhaps the sort of, I don't know, partially non-practicing religious Zionist, his desire for Yehuda and Shomron, his decision to go into Jerusalem and conquer the old city. Where does that fit in?
Well, okay.
So that's question one. Question two, on the metaphysical quality, would you include outside of the land any statement about Mikdash? Because if I'm not correct, tell me, doesn't Rambam or even Rav Soloveitchik in his discussions talk about the multidimensional Kedusha of that as it possesses a metaphysical quality?
Okay, so So the first question I think was about I'm not sure what the valence of the question is about. Is Menachem Begin part of this religious Zionist theology?
Right.
I mean, I would honestly say I don't know enough about how much Begin wrote about his theological passions. I would say that Begin found deeply ambivalent common cause with the settler movement in the following way. He believed, right, that the Jewish people should settle Judea and Samaria, and he believed that they were the people most likely to do it, but he also was extremely troubled by what he saw as their complete indifference to the law in making that happen. And in fact, he felt this kind of competitive thing with them where he wanted his government to control which sections of the West Bank were conquered when, and not to wake up every morning and find that 15 guys had just planted themselves on a hill somewhere. He had like disdain for that. So his relationship with them was both admiring and profoundly ambivalent. If you're asking a question about sort of his theology, I don't know, and I don't know if we know, right? I have always thought about Begin, rightly or wrongly, right, as in the end, a religious member of the revisionist wing of Zionism, the Jabotinsky wing, rather than someone who makes sense to say is a religious Zionist. And if it makes sense at some point during a question and answer session one of these weeks, we can talk about whether being a religious Zionist is equivalent to being a religious Zionist. Right? Yishayahu Leibovitz, right, spent the second part of his career insisting not, right? After around 1952, right, he said, I'm a political Zionist and I'm religious. And what do those two things have to do with each other? Nothing. So it's very complex there. Now, in terms of the question about the temple and the Rambam, I don't know how to do this without pulling out some paragraphs in the Rambam, and we can do that, you and I, sometime. But there have been people who have wanted to read the Rambam that way, and there have been people, Eli Schweid, Menachem Kellner, many others, who have said, actually, even about the Mikdash, right, it's clear that the holiness of the Mikdash is A, it's a place that God has chosen, and B, it's a place where various historically significant things have happened. But in no way does that mean that that piece of earth is somehow metaphysically distinct. And maybe we can sort of make that clear. The notion that God values something is not the same as saying, right, it is its own entity in the cosmos. Right? That's a distinction that's important to keep in mind. Maybe one more and then we'll stop. The last question, but let him go first.
I guess exactly that last point was what I wanted to ask about in some way. I'm not really convinced about the actual significance, the nafkamina, if you will, of what you're saying is metaphysical, cosmic significance. And I think that last way that you said it might be a good place to clarify. What really is the difference between saying God values this and whatever other words you choose to use? Once you can say God values this, that is holy, that is elevated beyond anything. anything else?
I think it's a very good question. And I don't think it's a good question, I think it's a hard question. And I would say this. I'm trying this on, okay? You can, from halachic sources, go to some very radical, uncompromising places. But you can, from halachic sources, also not go there, and you can also go to some very dramatically different halachic places. So that, for example, if I say, look, Eretz Yisrael in its entirety has some halachic status, but Pikuach Nefesh has a higher status, saving lives has a higher status, or in Moshe Una's idiom, right, the ethical well-being of my people has a higher status, halachic value of the land is not absolute. Because no one really argues, unless they're already first inflected by this metaphysics, that the halachic significance of the land is the highest value there is in any halachic system. In other words, right, saying that it's a place that God values does not lead necessarily to a kind of implacability around political compromise. Because, right, okay, there are lots of things God values. God values that I not drive on Shabbat. But if, God forbid, my son needs me to take him to the hospital, I'll do that. And that halachic obligation trumps the first one. So what I'm suggesting is the metaphysicalization of the land, it ups the ante so dramatically that every other value begins to pale in comparison. That, by the way, was the later of Amital's critique of all his former friends, which is, what about everything else Judaism says? Right? Whereas he wonderfully says, what about the Torah's concern with health care for the poor? What about that? Right? What are the consequences of this kind of monomania where it's the only value? And I think there's a huge gap there between halakha and metaphysics. Because no individual halakhic norm is ultimate.
I was just wondering if...
Microphone, just hang on 1 second. Can you get your microphone?
When you were just talking about Tzvi Yehuda and the direction that the Cook philosophy took, I was wondering, is that something that back in 1967 he anticipated? That you think that he and his group anticipated where they would be ending up today? Or is it something that just sort of... was like a snowball, and it happened.
So the question is, right, did Tzvi Yehuda and his circle anticipate where this is going to end up? And I would say, the short answer is no. I'll explain that in a second. But I think Tzvi Yehuda is already very clear that if it does end up there, we're ready for battle. Now, the reason why I think no is that, and this will be a kind of central piece of the final lecture, and possibly the fifth as well, right? Religious Zionists have so often operated on this assumption, inflected both by Kabbalah on the one hand, and by Hegel, oddly, on the other, that stuff was happening that was different than what the people who were doing it thought it was. That is what Hegel called the cunning of history, right? In other words, people think they're engaged in action X, but really they're engaged in action Y. Secular Zionists think they're building a secular political state. In fact, they are ushering in the throne of God on earth. Or as Rav Cook will say, we will spend a great deal of time in the fifth lecture on this, perhaps the most fateful line in some ways in the history of religious Zionism, I would suggest. When Rav Cook, talking about secular Zionists, says, Ma shehem rotzim einam yodim ba'atzma. Right? What they want, they themselves do not know. Right? They are animated by impulses and aspirations that are other than the ones that are available at their most conscious level. This means that many religious Zionists, not all, spent a lot of their history assuming that all the stuff that was not to their liking would fade. And so eventually, secular Zionists would actually understand their true innermost motivation and would come around. And I would even say something else. I think Tzvi Yehuda believed, going back to his father, that the land of Israel is so inherently transformative that if we could just take it over, it would cause the fading of heresy. Now, that might sound completely nuts to you, right? As like someone living in, you know, 21st century America. But in other words, if the land of Israel itself has a spiritual impact on those who dwell there, then the more of that land we have, the more likely it is to dispel the heresies and the denials of secular Zionists. And as I mentioned last time, and this is sort of how I ended last time, right? There is a kind of explosiveness, right? When you insist that you see more deeply into history as it's unfolding than anybody else, and you understand its innermost impulses, then when history turns out not to be what you thought it was, but rather what it said it was, all hell breaks loose. And I would suggest that the spasms of violence that have overtaken the religious Zionist world, beginning with the Machteret in the 80s, the underground, the Rabin assassination, increasingly stuff around the Hitnakut, the radicalization of some of Tzvi Yehuda's circle to the point of actively, you know, initiating violence against Arabs, Moshe Levinger, others, right, is actually about the explosion of a theology that becomes harder and harder to hold. I claim to know what is really going on here, and the more reality refuses to go along with my narrative, it's like a powder keg. It's chomer nefetz, right? It's dynamite. Because at a certain point, I act out against those who refuse to conform to my narrative of who they are. That's the dilemma of that kind of messianism. The messianism that claims to see the inner causes, and Kabbalah nurtures that too. You have to look not at what appears, but you have to look, right, at the inner. That's what Sfirat Chochmah is all about. Seeing the inner unity where other people only see division. Right? Well, what happens when history doesn't play along? Right? You just basically, now you don't have to come to my fifth lecture about secular Zionists. But I think it's actually very, very important. This issue is as critical as it could be. Rav Kook could at least say, secular Zionists, they're idealists. And then come to Yehuda students and say, maybe this is a caricature, but for the cafes in Tel Aviv, this is who I legitimated and said that they were the vehicles for bringing God's throne to earth. The high-tech crowd in Tel Aviv? Really? Wait a second. My father said, right, they would retain their idealism and their secularity would fall away. And you know what happened? They maintained their secularity and their idealism fell away.
But it's...
I'm angry. Right? My narrative that legitimated my participation in the Zionist project is collapsing. It was only okay because I told myself they were other than they were. And it turns out they might very well be exactly who they said they were. Now what happens? Well, I begin to disassociate myself from the state. Maybe it's not surprising what I said, which is, right, I become in certain ways no longer a Zionist. Because Zionism lied to me. Or I lied to myself about Zionism. Right? That's the tragedy. Right? And you can condemn it politically, but I think it's important to compassionately imagine the crisis that that entails. Right? The history of religion is filled with the prophecies that didn't come true, and what ends up happening in different ways is some weird amalgam of disillusionment and reaffirming the belief even more strongly. If you think that the collapse of the messianic dream means that the messianic dream dies, I invite you to take a subway to Crown Heights. It's the same phenomenon. It's not as violent. It's not violent. But it's the same idea. Right? There was a messianic fantasy. Turned out not to be true. What do I do? Okay. Thank you.
Shut.